Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you listening in. And lots of lines are already filled here, Sandy, but let's give the number. It's 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Nice to have you back.
It's nice to be back. You know, yesterday I had to give I volunteered to give a lecture to the students on kind of new gadgets for pets. And it's amazing the stuff that's out there. And in fact, right before we came on the air, Larry and I were trying to look up, there's a new, very small digital camera that looks almost like about the size of a big dog tag that the dog or cat wears on its collar. And I can't think of the name of it, but I'm sure anyone could find it. But it takes pictures every 1, 5, or 15 minutes. And so you just put it on your pet, and they say, you know, for dogs with separation anxiety, you can see what they're doing. Are they just pining for you outside the window? Or, you know, if you've got a cat that's an indoor-outdoor cat, where do they spend their day? And I thought that was kind of cool. And I think from the behavior standpoint, we could probably make some use of that to figure out
you learn some things from that.
What your dogs do and why you're gone. Yeah.
How much, do you remember how much they cost?
They weren't that expensive. It was, I think, $69 or something like that. You can download the pictures to your computer and, you know, just... I know right now my pets would be like just laying on the couch and there would be no movement for probably 8 hours.
Yeah. But from a behavior standpoint, yeah.
I think that would be really great. You know, yeah. If you're wondering, you know, who's chewing up what or who's doing what, you may be able to find out. Yeah.
Well, let's go to Judy in Madison, see what's on her mind. Judy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm so happy to talk with Dr. Sawchuk. I was just at the vet clinic yesterday and talked with Rich, took care of us, and he just sang her praises about what a wonderful instructor she was.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. My problem is I have a 7-year-old rat terrier who over the past year seems to be losing his hearing. The regular vet says it just seems to be normal hearing loss or whatever. I'm retired and on a fixed income, so I am wondering quality of life for him, if that's what it is, if it's something that may be fixed, if it would be worth going in to have checked out. He's a very friendly, laid-back dog. It doesn't seem to be bothering him.
Okay.
He does have another, his lives with his father, who seems to be taking care of him well. It's like having a senile dog for a dog, but it's a hearing dog.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, hearing loss is a common aging change in dogs, just like it is in people. And, excuse me, but... what I would be making sure that there's nothing going on, like an ear infection, middle ear infection, which would mean just getting, a veterinarian who's good with an otoscope, which is, you know, just one of those little devices that they look in our ears with, having a good look down in the dog's ear to see if there's a normal eardrum, the ear canal's normal, they're not packed with wax or hair or anything like that. Getting in, if the eardrum is looking bulging or, you know, there's something abnormal down there, then we're looking at doing it, going to the next level, which would involve probably getting a CT scan of your dog's head to be able to look at that middle ear cavity and inner ear to see if there's something going on there. I don't know if you really want to go that far. The real, you know, question then is, what do you do when you get an answer? If we don't find something medically fixable, like an ear infection, where do you go? With people, they make hearing aids, and that helps amplify the sound. A few years ago, probably 20 years ago, they did come out with hearing aids for dogs, but very few dogs like to wear them because they had to sit in the ear canal using acoustical foam to try to hold them in. And I had a couple of people come in requesting them, but it wasn't anything that we ever, you know, got them fitted for. So I don't think they're being made anymore. But I think things that you can do, there's a collar, a training collar on the market for dogs that is not a shock collar, but a vibrating collar. And I've had people that have had dogs that have been hearing impaired use that as a way of being able to call their dog. If they're out in the backyard, it's a way of saying, hey, look at me. And so training them that by that buzz of that neck, you know, just like us having a little, like a vibrating phone or pager go, it tells us, hey, somebody needs us. It's the same thing, except the dog wears it around their neck. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a really humane, interesting way of training and working with a trainer to be able to help you do that. Other things that I've had people do that have had dogs that are hearing impaired is teaching them, especially at night, like a flashing of the door light means come on in right now. You need to be your dog's ears as well and making sure that they're always in a good environment where they're not going to be exposed to traffic, other dogs that they may not be able to hear approach. So going to the dog park probably wouldn't be a good idea. You know, having an unfenced backyard, again, probably not a great idea. But they can lead very, very normal lives with just a little extra special care.
Yeah, good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Arlene in New Berlin, it's your turn. Hi, Arlene.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a miniature poodle, and I want to know, he has a little bump on his back. It's a fleshy color. It is, and it's not real hard. And I'm just wondering what it would be. I had him to the vet in July, and the vet never said anything, so I'm wondering what it would be.
How old is your dog?
His name is Hershey. He's 5 years old.
5 years old. All right. You know, anytime we get lumps or bumps in, there's, you know, probably one of the most common things that causes a fleshy, I kind of call it pink cauliflower. It may have kind of a little nubbly look to it. It may be a little greasy. There are benign growths, and poodles are very prone to them, and they're called sebaceous adenomas. They're benign growths of the sebaceous glands, which are the glands that make the oils for the hair coat.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other tumors that can look just like that.
Yeah.
And I always think that it's just a nice comfort to know that this is nothing to be concerned about. And the easiest way to be able to get an answer would be to do a needle biopsy. Just taking a needle, just like you would for doing a vaccination or anything else, but instead you're collecting some of the cells from that little skin bump and putting them on a slide and having your veterinarian have a look at them.
Mm-hmm.
That can help rule out more serious tumors. There's one that can look like this called a mast cell tumor, which can be quite locally invasive as well as spreading other places in the body. So the next time you're into your veterinarian, make sure that you ask them about this. And if it's the size that they could get a little needle into it, it may give you some peace of mind.
It's about the size of a pea.
Yeah, and that's about the size they normally are. And that would be big enough to get a little biopsy of.
thank you very much.
Just have to warn the groomer that it's there so they don't nick it, and that's the big problem. And sometimes they can get a little itchy for dogs, and we do remove them sometimes with laser or just surgically take a little punch and take it off and a little stitch in there.
Okay. Thanks for calling, Arlene. Appreciate it. James in the Shota, your turn now. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have to apologize for not having a health-related question, but I'm curious. Are cats, is it possible to behavior train a cat?
Definitely. Cats can be trained. They just train a little bit differently than dogs because dogs tend to be, you know, there to please us. You know, what do they say? You know, cats, you know, use us as staff or whatever. You know, the dogs have owners, cats have staff. You have to know what motivates the cat. And for many cats, it's food. And I've trained cats to sit and lay down and roll over by using a clicker and a spoonful of wet cat food. And so there's ways that you can train your cat. They respond very well to clicker training. And if you just do an online search, there's lots of books and videos and things like that out there on how to clicker train. And in fact, this is the kind of training that they've used for training chickens. I even saw online a fish agility course where you can train a fish through, you know, to go through different things with food and so on. And I mean, I think somebody has a lot of time in their hands if they want to do that. But I've even seen videos of my trainers of trained fish. So it's something that can be done. It's just a matter of knowing what motivates the cat and keeping their attention, not using punishment and training to their abilities. You know, having a cat, you know, do something that a dog would do, like fetch. You know, some cats like to do that.
Crusty would do that.
Yeah, and so that would be something that if you see what their natural desire to do, like maybe if they like to lay down and stretch, turn that into a rollover. Or if they, you know, will reach their paw up to beg for food, maybe turn that into a high five or a shake. But you can definitely shape their behavior. So good luck and have fun doing it.
Have fun. Thanks a lot for calling. Tom and Sobieski, it's your turn next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I've got my dog, Abby. She's a Labrador Retriever.
Okay.
We noticed about maybe 3 months ago she had a spot on her side that was totally bald. And recently that's filled in, but she's been licking her paws, and she lost a lot of hair underneath her chest, and now she's starting to lose it the upper chest more and on her front of her legs, front leg.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And she does have a little bit of decreased hair right where her ears are.
Okay.
We've taken her to the vet, and he did the scrape for mites.
Okay.
Which was negative. And they didn't do a thyroid check because of the itching. It looks more like an allergy.
Right.
They put her on chlorpheniramine, 4 milligrams.
Okay.
Q8.
Mm-hmm.
And we also added some cod liver oil to her food.
Okay.
Three other dogs in the neighborhood have a similar type problem, and one's even on cyclosporin.
Okay. Well, that just shows you how common allergies are. And if you went around and polled the human population right now, I bet you'd find a large percentage of us are suffering from hay fever right now. This is a really heavy time of the year with a lot of stuff pollinating. And, you know, it's just it happens to be kind of the peak of allergy season, not only for people, but for dogs. When dogs are exposed to allergens, it's not only contact allergens, like being out in the grass and so on, but also inhaled allergens. Their allergy organ is their skin, and they itch. And the classic response that dogs have are licking their feet and scratching their ears, and then sometimes it can just spread other places. Most dogs, and it sounds like your veterinarian is looking for other underlying causes like mites. Mites can be hard to find. Probably one of the more common mites that causes dogs to be intensely itchy is called scabies. And there are times where we just resort to response to therapy. We treat them to see if they do get better. And in some cases they do, and we've diagnosed mites through response to therapy. So one scraping may not be enough. Maybe a dozen or so, you may be able to be lucky to find mites. You also need to look for secondary infections. When dogs have been licking and scratching, their skin is so irritated that they can run into troubles with overgrowth of bacteria on their skin, usually a staph infection, as well as yeast. And that can even drive the itching as well. And so they start out with allergies, and now you've got infections on top of it. And so doing some scrapings for cytology, not just for mites, but actually looking for bacteria between the toes, under the armpits, belly, and so on, as well as yeast overgrowth, and treating that appropriately as well. There's a whole gamut of things that we can do for dogs with allergies. Antihistamines, like the chlorpheniramine that your veterinarian started your dog on, tends to not be very effective. Antihistamines in dogs may take the edge off, but they do very little. And I find that that's like one thing that you can do, but may not be helpful. Fatty acid supplementation, making sure that you've got really good levels of the active ingredients, are also important. And so using a fatty acid either that your veterinarian will prescribe, not just something over-the-counter. If you do pick up something over-the-counter, make sure that you go to your veterinarian and say, does this have the right levels of active ingredients in it? So that you're not just giving oils willy-nilly, but giving the right levels of EPA and so on, the active ingredients that are in fatty acids that help block the inflammatory response in the skin. Treating the infections too, like I mentioned, but sometimes treating with topical steroids helps. Sprays for the feet, drops for the ears if the ears are itchy may help as well. And then we get into other things, oral steroids, cyclosporin, which is a drug that people will take when they have organ transplants as to stop rejection. We're using it at lower levels to help block the inflammatory response in the skin. Hmm. So there's a whole host of things that we can do. Diet sometimes helps as well, and you may want to talk to your veterinarian about a hypoallergenic diet. Sometimes they have extra fatty acids in it to help dogs too. So
lots to think about.
Lots to think about, but I think it might be time to go back and say, you know, does my dog have an infection and does that need to be treated too?
And good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Larry Mueller here. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Joan in Green Bay is up next, so let's go to Joan. Hi, Joan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question involves giving a dog a ham bone, or is there any kind of bone that you could let a dog chew on?
Well, you know, our dental staff at the veterinary school says that anything that if you took that item and hit yourself in the shin with it and if it hurt, shouldn't go in the dog's mouth. They tend to be very purist from the standpoint of when it's hard like that, it can break teeth. And so depending on the size of your dog, their chewing capabilities, you really have to be careful with the size of the bone that you give the dog and be aware that they can cause some dental disease. And unless you're prepared for, you know, doing root canals and tooth extractions and so on, if the dog does fracture a tooth, I'd say avoid using bones. They do make sterilized beef bones for dogs. And they're big enough that they can't swallow them. Sometimes you can stuff them with things and that gives the dog something to lick on. They may not be chewing on them, but they be maybe using the bone as a vehicle for getting something to keep them occupied. That might work, but boy, you know, these little ham bones and things, I've had them actually get caught, like a round steak bone or a small circular ham bone over the lower jaw of the dog, and how they get them past the teeth and lodged over their lower jaw, I have no idea. But we've picked out a lot of bones from stomachs, esophaguses, it's just, I think it's not the safest thing.
Okay. There you have it, Joan. Thank you for calling. And let's go to Eileen next in Park Falls. Hi, Eileen.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 9-year-old German Shepherd dog. And a year or so ago, she was diagnosed with spinal stenosis, which I believe they said means that her spinal cord is being pinched.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she's losing, or she's pretty much lost, control over her back legs. She drags them mostly. My question is this going to be impairing her bowel or bladder function?
It depends on where the pinching is occurring. There's one of the more common spots where we see the spinal cord being pinched is what's called lumbosacral stenosis or instability, where the lower back meets the bones that make up the sacrum, which is part of the pelvic system. That's a spot where there can be a lot of stressors, and you can get problems with the disc, the little pillowy type thing that sits between the vertebra will sometimes slip out of place and cause some problems, or you get bony changes if there's a lot of movement there. The body tries to fuse those vertebra to prevent that instability, and that can push on the nerves. Dogs that present with that may have lower back pain. Depending on the nerves that are being compressed, you may see decreased tail movement. You can see problems with the back legs and sometimes being a little weak in the back legs. The anus may be affected, and so you may have decreased anal tone, and they may not be able to empty their bladder properly. What I get concerned about is if your dog is really that weak in the back legs, there's another condition that German Shepherd dogs can get, that is similar to MS in people, in that it's a degenerative change of the spinal cord called degenerative myelopathy. It comes down to, it's a rule out process. When one of these dogs comes in to see our neurology staff, they, besides doing a complete neurologic exam to try to figure out where the problem's occurring along the back by checking reflexes, locations for pain, and so on, they may then send the dog for an MRI of their back to be able to look at the disc spaces and the spinal cord to see if everything's normal. We also see in 9-year-old dogs sometimes things like slow-growing spinal cord tumors that can also cause these types of symptoms. So, you know, don't assume that it's just this. And if it is spinal cord compression because of disc disease, that may be something that could be surgically repaired so that your dog can lead a more normal life.
Hmm.
They said that she had severe arthritis in her lumbar spine.
Okay.
And that she had bridging.
Okay.
Across all of her...
her vertebra. Yeah.
All the vertebra. But they also said that she broke every one of the bridges.
Okay.
And they said that was probably kind of a painful thing to have happen.
Yeah.
And they said that the pinching in the spine was closer to the tail.
Okay. So that is probably this lumbosacral instability. And they do surgery for that, where they take the tops off the vertebra to free up the nerves that are there so they're no longer being compressed. They put a fat graft in, close everything up. So it is something that does get surgically repaired, and pets do very well after surgery. So again, don't give up if it's something that you want to see your dog. She's only 9, could go on to lead a more normal life for many years.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for your call, Eileen. Appreciate it. And let's go to Louise in Hillsborough next. Louise, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was up visiting my son in upstate New York about a month ago, and their wonderful 7-year-old golden retriever, small golden retriever, jumped up to greet me, and I kind of grabbed her upper arms there, and I could feel a large lump. They went in, or they took her in, and indeed she had cancer. And last Thursday they amputated her right leg.
Oh my goodness!
But I know that her right front leg, and they're calling her tripod now.
Okay.
But anyway, she. What I'm concerned about is, I know in people bone cancer is not usually a primary site, and I'm a little bit concerned what they should be looking for.
Well, in dogs, we do see primary osteosarcomas, where they actually occur in, you know, the forelimbs. I'm surprised if you felt the mass there that she wasn't showing some signs of discomfort prior to that. The main reason why legs are amputated is by the time the tumor is diagnosed, it's usually spread around the body. And amputation is palliative in that it helps alleviate the source of pain in the bone. This is a type of cancer that I know that the vet school, the oncology service, has various protocols that they use to help treat these dogs to, you know, get rid of some of the microscopic disease that they assume is already spread throughout the body. So besides amputation, they may want to be looking into, does chemotherapy, would it help this dog? And they'd probably want to stage her by taking chest x-rays, doing abdominal ultrasound, some blood work, and so on, to see if there's, you know, any other visible disease elsewhere in the body. I'm not sure if that's something that they would want to consider doing. But, you know, it's interesting. I think amputation is something that, as a human being, we, you know, look at it as how it's going to affect us socially. There's a lot of emotional involvement. With pets, you get rid of the pain, and they are just
they're happy.
And if they weren't using the leg already, you know, they're happy to be rid of it almost. And they don't have the social implications that we have. And so if the dog's comfortable and happy, I'm so glad for them. And hopefully she'll, you know, be able to have several months of good health before the disease actually takes over.
Mm. Thank you, Louise, for calling. Appreciate your call. Patty in Dubuque, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Patty.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. See, my son moved home about a year ago and brought with him his 2-year-old chocolate lab. This lab has an insatiable appetite.
Oh, yes. Welcome to the world of labs, yes.
Yeah. He's actually chewed through the pen fencing and removed siding from the shed door to get at the food.
Okay.
And this is even, like, right after she's eaten.
Huh. Are you sure she's chewing to get at the food, or is she chewing for other reasons, such as she wants to, you know, regain access to her human beings, like trying to escape?
No.
And no? Okay.
No, because the food is inside a closed shed.
Uh-huh.
And she could access the food bag, and she keeps trying to get inside the shed to get at the food.
All right. You may want to consider having the food in the house or in an area where, I mean, hopefully she won't start chewing on your siding. I just have had a hard time seeing that she would go through that much effort to get at food. But it's not surprising. I mean, I've had dogs, you know, learn to open cabinets and refrigerators and so on and just kind of eat their way through the kitchen. But keeping the food in a locked container, they do make, you know, plastic tubs and things with lids that lock. That would probably be a little safer. You know, garbage cans with, you know, lids that are on nice and tight.
Yeah, that's what it's in right now, and she's learned how to open them up.
Oh, my goodness. Sounds like a pretty smart dog.
She is.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we do for dogs that are fast eaters, that you know, just wolf their food down and are looking for more, is we try to slow them down by providing them their dinner in one of these food dispensing toys. There's several of them on the market. There's one that's called the Cube. There's different balls and things that you can load with her kibble. One of my favorites is called the Tug-a-Jug, and it's a very indestructible jug that you can put her food in. It's got a rope in it with a knot, and she's got to kind of play with the knot, and food falls out as she plays with this toy. And that would be one way of giving her, one, some mental stimulation that may prevent her from wanting to escape to get to the food and keep her occupied, but it also slows her eating down. I know with people, they always say, you know, if you eat quickly, your body doesn't send you those signals to stop eating until, you know, much later. So, you know, slowing your eating down gives you those satiety factors that make you stop eating. By slowing a dog down, same thing can happen. She may not be as quite as food driven. So, you know, perhaps giving her a little more enrichment in her pen may help save your house.
Yep, good idea. Thanks for calling, Patty. Rebecca in Clintonville, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a wonderful cat named Gracie who has LPGS. And on advice, we took her yesterday to the UW, to the vet school, and they went and put her under and to give her a biopsy. While she was under, they examined all of the teeth and cleaned ones that they weren't going to take out. And they took out all but six teeth because she had resorptive, I think I pronounced it right, where her body's absorbing the enamel from the teeth. So they took out a lot of teeth. And they didn't want to take them all out at once, which makes sense because you know, they were concerned about how long she would be under the anesthesia. They'd rather do it in two things. What they sent us home was some pain medicine that we're supposed to try and get under her tongue or at least into her mouth. But we're also supposed to be very, very careful of the sutures in her mouth.
Okay.
She is, I mean, just, you get anywhere near her. I've tried, like, massaging her body, starting at her shoulders and working up to the back of her head and to the front of top of her head and then kind of down the sides, trying to get my hand near her mouth.
And it's too painful.
Oh, she won't have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
She's got this pain. And so is there some other way to get her pain medicine? They said not to put it in with the food.
It doesn't work that way. Yeah,
it has to be absorbed.
Well, I'm going to just back up here a little bit, and just before we get into dealing with her postoperative pain.
Yes,
LPGS, it sounds like ladies pro golf something or whatever, but it stands for lymphocytic plasmacytic gingivitis stomatitis.
Oh.
Long name, but what it basically is an immune problem where the cat's body starts recognizing the gum tissue almost as foreign. And it's probably a hypersensitivity reaction to the bacteria and the plaque on the teeth. And most of these cats will respond beautifully to extracting the teeth, the source of plaque in the mouth. And so you get rid of all their teeth and they do phenomenally well. It's diagnosed not only visually but by biopsy as well. And the other thing that she's got going on, which is a common problem in cats, they sometimes call them neck lesions or cervical erosive lesions, are these little cavities that occur right around the gum line of the tooth where the root and the crown meet. It happens to be a spot in the tooth where the cat has a kind of a little blank spot where it doesn't have any dentin or enamel, so that you've got a kind of sensitive spot there in the tooth, and they'll get these cavities forming, which are not like our cavities, which are due to the effects of bacteria making acids and that destroying our enamel. This is a very, very different process. It's common in cats. There's nothing we can do to really stop it except try to keep the cat's mouth as clean as we can. And when we've got these resorptive lesions already present, the best thing we can do is extract the teeth and get them out of there because they're just going to progress to cause a problem for your cat. So she had a double whammy. She not only had this hypersensitivity to the plaque, but also these cavities that were occurring. And she's probably going to be a happier cat in the long run, having all these teeth removed. But in the meantime, what are we going to do? They sent home the typical pain medication that cats tolerate real well called buprenorphine drops. They're sublingual drops. They need to be applied to the gum tissue to get absorbed. They don't get absorbed well if they're swallowed. So it's sometimes easier to get it in a cat because you lift the lip up. But when you've got a cat with a sore mouth, may not be the easiest to get in. I would be recommending that you give a call back to the veterinary school again. She may be a good candidate for, you know, something like a fentanyl patch, which would be a little patch that, you know, that they shave a spot and they may, you know, put something like that on, or where it goes through the skin. The pain management is through the skin, and that may make it a little bit easier for her. It's, you know, again, talk to the dentist. There are other things that we can do. I know that they did a nerve block yesterday. That's probably wearing off right now, and having her go without something is not fair to her. The other drug that we'll sometimes use is called meloxicam. It's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, kind of like ibuprofen that we take, but it's one that's labeled for cat use in liquid form. That you can give with food. I don't know how much food she's going to be taking in right now with her mouth being this sore, but that may be another drug. If they didn't dispense that, that would be something else that we could have dispensed. You have to use it very carefully in cats, though, because you have to dose them appropriately, very unlike a dog. So it's a totally different dosage regime.
All right.
Well, and she's doing beautifully. Now, they shaved her front leg to put the IV in. Could they use that if we went with the fentanyl patch?
No, because that's a spot where she would be able to lick it off, and then she would eat it, and it would be a problem. So we usually put them on over the trunk, and sometimes they have to even have an e-collar on or something to prevent them from being able to get at it. But it goes up over the back usually.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Rebecca. Appreciate it. We had an email from Eunice who says, my cat has extremely dry skin. When I had her groomed last year, the groomer suggested I put mineral oil on her skin. I'm concerned that could be harmful as she bathes herself. Is mineral oil safe for her to ingest? I do put some drops of oil I bought from the pet store in her food, but I think that's a different kind of oil.
Yeah, the fatty acids and things that you put in the food may help with improving the skin barrier and make them feel a little bit better. A few things that she may want to be looking at. The number one cause for cats that I see that have flaky skin is usually because they're obese. An overweight cat that can't groom themselves is going to have oils and things and dead skin building up primarily over their back. And these are cats that going on a weight loss program so that they can then groom themselves are going to be a lot happier. Some of these cats need to be bathed more frequently. If they can't bathe themselves, we need to do it for them. And that may help. And using an anti-seborrheic shampoo may make a big difference. My favorite line of shampoos is one by a company called Duxo. It's D-U-O-X-O. It's a French company, but they have one that's an anti-seborrheic. They have a spray, and they also have a shampoo that work very well for both cats and dogs. Using mineral oil on the coat, besides being messy, I can't imagine having a greasy cat laying on your furniture. That is not an emollient at all. It's just going to make the cat greasy. So the groomer didn't know what they were talking about. I'd say nix that. It's a non-absorbed oil. The big problem is if owners try to give mineral oil orally, like for treating hairballs and things, which you shouldn't do, cats can inhale it. It's kind of this funny texture, and it may go down the wrong tube and can cause problems. So avoid using mineral oil.
All right. On to Dale in Brookfield. Dale, hi to you.
Hey, hello, Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
I've got a 3-year-old female, healthy 50-pound boxer, and 3 weeks ago started hearing her grind her teeth.
Okay.
No trouble eating. Everything is still healthy, runs and plays, and I don't know what. I felt them. There's no loose teeth.
Okay.
No sharp edges.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Does she play a lot of tug of war, play ball with things, and always have something in her mouth?
She likes to bring a toy to me every time I come home. It's just two adults.
Okay.
And we play in the backyard retrieving balls.
Okay.
No tug of war.
No tug of war. Okay, the reason why I ask is we had one of the police dogs in that work here in our community with a very similar type problem, grinding their teeth and acting uncomfortable. And guess what? They had TMJ, temporomandibular joint arthritis. And so, you know, that might be something to consider. I've also seen teeth grinding with dogs with, like, stomach upset. They may, you know, do a little more grinding and things that way. But it sounds like she's eating well and isn't, you know, having any gastrointestinal pain. So I doubt that that's what the problem is. But, you know, this is something that you know, you may be able to look at the teeth and say, yeah, they look all right. A professional, though, looking at the teeth may find that there's some abnormalities there that could be causing some trouble and maybe causing some oral pain. So I'd still recommend that you take her in to your veterinarian. They may want to get some x-rays done or at least a good thorough oral examination. Sometimes we can do that in a conscious state. Sometimes it has to be done with them asleep. But if they are more comfortable sending your dog to a veterinary dentist, we now have at the veterinary school a full-time dental service. So that would be something that you may want to look into.
All right.
Good.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Holly in Onalaska is up next. Hi, Holly.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a puppy that just recently recovered from the parvovirus. She's 6 months old. She weighs about 5 pounds. She's a Maltese Pomeranian mix.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is she's peeing, she's pooping, you know, she's not vomiting anymore. She's, you know, a lot better. She was near death and everything. But just recently on Friday, I had her in, and they said that they wanted to give her distemper shot anyways.
Mm-hmm.
The one vet said, no, she's going to have this crazy, you know, antibodies in her body. She won't need it. The other one said, no, we better give it to her. So we gave it to her. But just today I noticed, and my daughter kind of noticed, she's like, she looks fat. And her belly, just her lower belly, just kind of feels full.
Hmm.
That thing that I could should be, and I thought maybe it was just gas, or that they did say, because mm-hmm. she went a whole week without eating. I mean, she was just, It was just heartbreaking to see her like this. But she's eating now, but they said, you know, before I was only feeding her twice a day, they said, well, you know, try and feed her like a half a cup 3 times a day,
okay.
You know, because she, you know, she did lose like a couple ounces. She didn't lose a lot, but I just was kind of concerned. I was like, you know, and you seem so knowledgeable and stuff. I'm like, maybe she knows what's wrong.
Well, I don't know why your dog's abdomen is being distended. It could just be that she's back to eating again. You went from having this dog that had this horrible gastrointestinal disease. Parvovirus is a virus that likes to hit rapidly growing cells. And so for dogs, the main place that it hits is the bone marrow, because those cells are rapidly being produced. And so the cells that are used to help fight off infection will drop, and we'll see them have very low white blood cell counts. They're more prone to getting an infection. The other place that it hits is the lining of the intestinal tract. And so you can imagine, without having a proper lining of your gut, all the bacteria that live there can enter the body. Now you don't have the cells to fight off infection. They can become septic, dehydrate, and die. It's an important disease that we do vaccinate for, and that's why we give a series of vaccinations to puppies to try to give them proper immunity to protect them if they do come in contact with this virus. And the virus is pretty much everywhere. It survives for a very long time in the environment. So taking your dog to the dog park, the pet store, you know, anywhere, boarding kennels, it's very, very stable virus, and some even normal dogs can be shedding it. So that's why you need to keep up with vaccinations. But remember, when we're vaccinating, you mentioned distemper. That's a totally different bug. Parvovirus is one of the diseases that is included in that multivalent vaccine that we give to puppies. And if your dog had just recently gotten over this horrible disease, vaccines are meant for healthy pets. And I refuse to vaccinate a dog if we know that they are, you know, just getting over something, or, you know, they're on drugs for, you know, cancer, they're on chemotherapy, or if they've had allergic reactions in the past. We like to only give them to healthy pets. So depending on when she just got over having parvovirus, which she's very lucky to have survived, it sounds like you've got a great group of veterinarians to get this little 5-pound dehydrated vomiting dog through this horrible disease.
Well, actually, they told me just to make her comfortable. It was It was a homeopathic doctor, and this stuff that I found online that was called Parvo-K, because they just told me she was going to die. And then I talked to a holistic vet in Viroqua, and they said, well, why don't you ask about giving her, just learning how to do it, the fluids underneath the skin, because I was on a fixed income, and they're like, well, $50 every time to get her, you know, you know, fluids in her and stuff underneath her skin. So I learned how to do that. And then the stuff that I found online, and within a couple of days, everything that was for Parvo for puppies just kept referring me back to this one, you know, stuff that I should give her.
Okay, well, you're
I should give her.
Yeah, you're really lucky that she survived. And she may have lifetime immunity from Parvo, but may not from for the other ingredients in that vaccine. So, you know, we don't want your dog to get distemper or dog hepatitis. And so, continue, you know, getting those other vaccines done, if she's healthy, is a good idea.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Your Pet's Health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Larry Mueller here. And Sandy, we've got an email from Anne who says her dog has had recurring problems with visible blood, mucus in the stool. This initially occurred after we took her to a dog park. Big mistake, she says. She was treated with antibiotics, Culturelle, and with yogurt. And this seemed to take care of part of the problem, but it has reoccurred. The stool lab test was negative. The vet said that she was to remain on Culturelle for the rest of her life. We were not told what is the problem. Antibiotics were not ordered. What would be the cause of this problem?
Ah.
And is there some other form of treatment? Should we be doing some other checking?
Yeah, definitely. I don't know what Culturelle is. That's a new product to me. It's a brand name. I have no idea what that is. But I can tell you, when we see blood and mucus, why do these calls always have to happen right before lunch or while people are eating? That tells me the only place that there's mucus glands in the dog's intestinal tract is in the large bowel or the colon area. Mm. And so when we see frank blood and mucus, that tells me that the dog has colitis, inflammation of the colon. And the way that I simplify this for my owners and students, and we have a case come in, is I call it the five Fs, and we now have changed it to the six Fs of treating colitis. Number one thing we do is we put a finger up our dogs. That's the first F, okay? Mm-hmm. So when we get a dog in, yes, veterinarians do that. We put a rubber glove on and we go up and have a feel. I had a dog in the other day that was straining, passing bloody mucusy stools, had a stick lodged sideways in its rectum. Oh. And so it was its stick eater. And so we got that out and the dog in a few days got back to normal. So always go up, have a feel. Sometimes we can then collect some fresh fecal material if it happens to be in there. We do like to run a fecal test for parasites. And so what this is looking for is the two most common kinds of parasites that can cause colitis are whipworms. Very difficult to diagnose because they shed their eggs intermittently. And the other one is called Giardia. And that can be hard to diagnose, too. I know when I had Giardia, it took at least three trips back to the doctor, carrying my little containers of stool, to be able to get the diagnosis. There's another test that we can do for Giardia called a Giardia antigen test, which costs a little more money, but sometimes that helps with getting a diagnosis. So we like to rule out those two parasites, but because sometimes the stool checks will be negative, we just resort to response to therapy. And the therapy, the third F, is fenbendazole, or a drug called Panacure. We put dogs on a round of Panacure. That gets Giardia, we'll get whipworms, the most common causes of colitis, and we'll also treat them with a drug called metronidazole, or we have to have an F there, Flagyl is the brand name of that drug. Don't I make this easy for my students? Okay. Finger, fecal, fenbendazole, Flagyl. Flagyl is a drug that not only gets Giardia as a parasite, but it also helps control some of the inflammation in the gut, as well as acting as an antibacterial agent as well. I don't know what antibiotics she was put on. Hopefully it was something like Flagyl. The other F that we do is we look at changing the diet and going on a diet that's going to give the colon a good rest. And we call these low-residue diets, low-fiber, low-fat, easy-to-digest diets that just causes the dog to make very little stool. So it kind of gives the colon a chance to recover. The last F is this drug called Fortiflora, which is a probiotic that Nestle Purina makes. And you don't necessarily have to use that one, but it just happens to be another F, which makes it easy to remember. And that may be what this Culturelle is a probiotic. I don't know if you were going online seeing if you could find it, but
it is a probiotic.
So that's what the veterinarian put them on. And that alone may help, but it's not going to be 100%. So I think it's time to go back to your veterinarian and say, let's get these other things off the table before we start jumping into scoping, biopsying, and all that an internist would do.
All right, on to Holly in Elm Grove. Holly, hello.
Good morning, and thank you.
Sure.
I've got a 7-year-old German Shepherd, and she loves to run up in the woods after all of the creatures that one can run after up in the woods. And early this spring, caught a stick of some kind, a scratch, something, near her little private feminine parts.
Okay.
And that turned into a wound. That wound got infected, and we've been fighting it with creams and antibiotics for about 4 or 5 months now.
Ooh.
And the vet has now said she needs a vulvoplasty.
Okay.
If I can say that.
Okay. You can. Yeah. You can. Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't want to do this because he says it's not going to tickle.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hate to have her hurt. But nonetheless, we're going to have to do this in early October, and I would like some ideas as to how, as soon as she comes home, I can keep her the most comfortable.
All right. Well, let me just back up here again for a second.
Yep.
I'm not sure how an injury from a stick has led to needing a vulvoplasty. Usually when dogs get, you know, poked or scratched and they have a wound that's not healing, what I start thinking about is there a piece of material, foreign material, still up in there? Does that area need to be explored to be able to get that foreign material out? It may be that just this triggered her to have some skin irritation around her vulva. It's anatomically, there are some dogs that have a bigger fold of skin covering up their female private parts.
Well, and that's what she says.
Yeah,
and she's got the most recessed vulva she's ever seen in her entire life.
Yeah, and so when dogs urinate then, they will get some urine scalding, and that can lead to infections because skin-on-skin contact like that is what Mother Nature did not intend. And basically what a vulvoplasty is kind of like if someone was getting a facelift, but on the other end of the dog's body. They take a moon-shaped piece of tissue off of her backside and kind of pull everything up and suture it. So she'll have sutures on her backside, and that allows that skin fold to no longer exist, opens it up so that it's easier to medicate topically, gets exposed to the air, things dry out, you don't no longer have urine scalding. It's a fairly common surgery that we do at the veterinary school. This is one of the things that if I was looking at a puppy, I would not take a puppy that has this vulvar conformation. And I, you know, if I have a litter, and we'll see litters come in, there'll be several that are normal and one that's abnormal. So, you know, this is something to be paying attention to when you're looking for a dog right from the get-go. Keeping dogs that have this problem slender helps. Keeping it clean, being on the lookout for infections. And, you know, sometimes we have to keep baby wipes or medicated wipes going to that area a couple of times a week, just like I do with my bulldogs, but I do it to their face because that's where they have their problem is all their facial folds. But it's a surgery that, yeah, it's not a fun one to do. It is just involving skin sutures. So most dogs bounce back very quickly because they can lick at it. Probably the most horrible thing for the dog is they have to wear one of those Elizabethan collars, the e-collars, so they can't get back there to chew. They will probably be on some type of an anti-inflammatory type pain medication afterwards. And that would be something that your veterinarian who knows your dog would be able to come up with the right dose and the right one. But that's, you know, pain management obviously is necessary after any surgery like this.
All right. Thank you very much.
Could I ask one more question?
All right.
One thing she said that might be of benefit to other listeners is that with the Humane Society spaying females at such very young ages, she's seeing more and more of this occur. I don't understand the mechanics as to why it would be, but she has recommended that anybody that gets a puppy from a humane society, be very careful about that because it's liable to become a problem.
I have to disagree. I'm going to disagree with your veterinarian. The one thing that we know is linked to early age spay neuter in dogs, female dogs, is urine leaking. Okay, so we'll see them becoming more having problems with incontinence, which if you've got a dog with this anatomical problem, can lead to urine scalding. So it's not that the early age spay neuter is causing the dog to have a recessed vulva. That's an anatomical variant that the dog is born with. And I think what we're seeing is because we're seeing more Labrador retrievers and other dogs that are becoming more popular, some of these larger breed dogs, this is something that we are, you know, selecting for in our dog population. And I think we also, because we are seeing dogs becoming overweight, obesity in pets is a huge problem, that dogs that have this conformation that normally would be able to live with it are getting overweight. It's increasing the amount of skin folding that we have, and that leads to problems. So don't think it's the, you know, I don't think that you're going to find anything statistically that says early age spay neuter is linked to this anatomical problem. I think it's, you know, there may be kind of a distant relationship there, but still get your pets from the Humane Society and still get them spayed. Yes.
Yeah. Absolutely. When are you supposed to spay your dogs and cats? At
well,
what age?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing cast in stone, but I know because we used to say, you know, the Humane Societies were doing early age spay neuters at like 8, 9, 10 weeks of age. They're now putting that off until the dogs are at least, 4 months of age or so.
Okay.
I prefer to let dogs finish up with their vaccination program and then have it done when they're 5 or 6 months of age, just because then all their teeth are in, and if they have any baby teeth that need to be pulled, that's a perfect time to do it, and we can do it at at that age.
All right. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today from the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Looking at your pet's health now with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. Lots of callers online, so we're going to go right to the phones. And Bridget in Rice Lake has been patiently waiting, so we go to Bridget. Hi, Bridget.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a 4-month-old puppy, and we got him when he was 8 weeks old. And ever since he has been at our house, he's had the hiccups at least 6 to 7 times a day.
And that's pretty normal.
Is it
puppies.
Okay?
It's very
kind of worried, but
very normal for puppies. But remember, what hiccups are is it's the diaphragm, that muscle layer that separates your chest cavity from your abdomen. Puppies have the same thing. It's getting some irritation to that or the nerves that supply it, and sometimes we'll see puppies have more hiccups when they have problems with GI distress. So if your dog has not been to a veterinarian to have a checkup for intestinal tract parasites, get them there. Take a fresh stool sample in, get that looked into. And just like we talked about prior to the news, sometimes just going through a round of therapeutic deworming. And since almost all puppies are born with some sort of parasites, they can get them from the mom, they can cross the placenta and when they're in the uterus, and they also get some parasites through the milk. It's a good idea to just generally treat pets with deworming agents, puppies and kittens, for those first few weeks of life. So if you haven't done that, time to get them in and do that. But it may just be normal. Yep.
All right. Thanks for calling. And Catherine in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, good morning. First of all, I wanted to comment to Sandy on her information that she presented on Parvo. It was so good. Our puppy, 16-week-old Beagle, survived Parvo, and when he went into the vet, he was only 7 pounds. He had lost a lot of weight with this. I knew nothing.
Oh boy!
About it. I knew nothing about it. He was at the Burnham Wood Veterinary Hospital for 1 week on IV fluids, antibiotics, and it took a good 4 days before he actually showed a sign of improvement. So he was really lucky to have survived that mm-hmm. virus.
Yes.
And is now, that was just recently, and is now eating good, going to the bathroom good, and gaining weight, and you'd never know that he had gone through all this.
Well, I'm glad that he survived. What can we answer
okay,
for you?
Okay, now, from a 16-week beagle to a 16-year poodle.
Okay.
Who is has such a thirst for water, and especially toward evening.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'll just decide he's going to go to the bathroom anywhere.
Okay.
And he had recently been to the vet, and they did a renal panel, which was totally normal. She didn't say anything about a urine specimen for checking for a UTI.
Okay.
But I have to keep a diaper on him now because he's getting to be very problematic.
Yeah, yeah.
Wanting water, will go and find water wherever he can, in the toilet or a puppy or whatever.
Well, I think that I'm not sure exactly what blood work your veterinarian did, but the top diseases that come to my mind in a 16-year-old dog that's suddenly drinking more water and actually seeking it out and drinking more and then urinating more frequently and to the point of even having accidents in the house, it's very unlikely that it's a urinary tract infection. That may be part of it, but that's probably not what's driving this. Most dogs with urinary tract infections don't urinate large volumes. It's like little bits are coming out because they're straining and their bladder wall is irritated. But the things that I think about in an old poodle, number one would be something like diabetes.
Was negative. His blood sugar was fine.
Negative. Good. So we've ruled that out. Good, because I didn't know what was on the blood work. Kidney disease and chronic kidney disease, you really need to check not only blood work, but a urine sample at the same time, preferably, because you can have dogs that have normal kidney values on the blood work, but may have very dilute urine, and they are not yet sick with their kidney disease, so the kidney toxin levels aren't increasing, but they still have, their kidneys have lost their ability to concentrate the urine, so it's just coming, pouring through their body, and they have to drink more to compensate for all the water that they're losing through their kidneys. So getting a urine sample in would be very helpful to make sure that your dog is concentrating their urine. And the best time to collect that would be maybe first thing in the morning when he's been sleeping all night and not up and drinking water in the middle of the night. That way you're going to see when at the time of the day when he should be the most concentrated that we're checking, and that may help get kidney disease actually off the table because you can't rule that out with just a blood test. The other thing that I worry about, common disease in poodles is called Cushing's disease, and it's overactive adrenal glands, and common symptom with that is drinking more and urinating more, and sometimes they will get, their hair will get a little thin, their skin may get thin, and eventually they'll get pot-bellied. And what we would be looking at when we're trying to diagnose that is on the blood work, you may see a liver enzyme called alkaline phosphatase increased. And if they ran just a kidney panel or a renal panel, as you said, they may not have looked at liver values. And that might be something to go back and say, let's do a full chemistry panel to rule this out. And that's something that is treatable. It's a disease that can be managed with medication. But it does need to be diagnosed first before you start, you know, giving them the appropriate drugs for that disease.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Gigi in Viroqua, we'll go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello.
Anybody there?
No.
No.
All right.
Must have lost her.
Okay.
Let's go to Nate in Green Bay. Hello, Nate.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. I guess my question is two parts. The first part of the question, I have a yellow lab, 6-year-old yellow lab. We just moved out onto a lake just outside of Green Bay, and he's in the water nearly every day. And this summer, we've noticed a pretty significant weight loss. And I didn't know if that was just due to increased activity. I haven't taken him to the vet at all, but a friend of mine said, you know, maybe it's worms. So that mm-hmm. would be the first part. I'm wondering if there's anything that I should do to take him in. I have increased his diet, but I thought the exercise and increased activity level being in the water nearly every day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that may be all that's going on. I mean, one of the recommendations is you should always, you know, if you're new to the Green Bay area, find a veterinarian that you feel comfortable with and be going in at least once, preferably twice a year for physical exams. I think that that's always a good idea. You can take a stool sample with you, but most dogs that are losing weight to a health problem are going to have some other signs of health disease, such as, you know, diarrhea, vomiting, decreased appetite. Something else is going to be going on. If he's active and feels good and eats his dinner and everything's normal, it could just be that he was a couch potato and he's turned into an athlete now. So good for you if that's all it is, that you found a way of giving your dog a better quality of life and a longer life, because dogs that are slender are going to live 15% longer than their overweight siblings. So Make sure you keep that weight off.
All right. Thanks
Well, she had another question.
Oh, I'm sorry. You did have another one.
If I may, the second part of my question.
Yeah, go ahead, Nate.
Is there any benefit to prophylactically treating or treating with a worm regimen or a deworming regimen for a dog that's outside in the wild?
All the time. Often? Well, yeah. I mean, we do that automatically. Every dog that lives in Wisconsin should be on heartworm preventative. And the heartworm preventatives that are out there, actually, we probably should rename them internal parasite control drugs, because
question, beyond heartworm, is there anything else they should be taking?
No, I mean, unless they're diagnosed with a problem. I think the big reason why we keep dogs on monthly heartworm preventative and these intestinal control agents that are part of the heartworm preventative is not only to keep the dog healthy, but to keep us healthy, because they act as a source of infection for us and the environment. So it's kind of a two-part reason why we do that. But unless something else is diagnosed, I wouldn't be doing anything else. If your dog is eating a lot of rodents and killing things and eating them, then there is a heartworm preventative that is called Ivorheart Max that not only gets roundworms and hookworms, but also has a tapeworm preventative in it. And that's a parasite that dogs that are catching prey and eating them may run into troubles with.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I had an email from a Madison person who says our indoor cat, 16 years old, is getting clingy, still is active, although not as frisky as in her youth. She becomes distressed when we're away. We have to be out of town several weekends this fall, and we'll have someone come in to take care of her, feed, water, clean the box, and play with her. Other than having someone live there when we're away, do you have any suggestions for how to keep her okay?
Oh, you know, and I think it's good that you're not putting her in a boarding kennel. A 16-year-old cat, they don't do well in a situation outside of their home environment. So keeping them in a spot where they're comfortable, trying to keep them on the same feeding schedule. And so if your pet sitter can do everything like you would, that's going to make life a little bit easier for your cat. There is a product on the market that may make your cat feel a little calmer. It's called Feel Away, and it's a plug-in atomizer of feline facial pheromone. And that's kind of a natural calmative for cats that kind of works. It's like aroma therapy with science behind it. So Think about plugging in something like that for your cat. You can get them through your veterinarian, or you can also get them at pet stores and pet supply catalogs. And don't get the dog product. There is one for dogs called DAP. Doesn't work for cats. You want the one that's specifically made for cats. But I think that that's really about all you can do. Yeah.
All right. Thanks again for that email. And let's go to Mary in Marquesan. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have listened to you so many times, and I never have a phone at hand that I can call you.
Well, I'm glad you finally got through.
And today is the day I need to speak to you.
Okay.
Well, I have a very sneaky daughter-in-law who managed to get me to the pound in Stevens Point. And I'm age 73, so I said, I know what you're doing. You're hoping somebody's going to adopt me.
Oh.
But anyway, we went through there, and I said, I'm not getting anything. Went all the way through. I'm leaving, and there is one room with two cats in it, and a big sign that said, we are buddies, we've been here forever, we can't stay any longer, we have to have a home right now.
Okay.
Well,
so you
know
took
what
her.
That means. Yep.
Yes. Okay.
And so I went inside, and I didn't even touch either of the cats that were in there. One was an orange tabby who was purring like crazy, and the other one was a calico.
Mm-hmm. So you took them both.
So Yes, I ended up bringing both of them home. I thought, who in the heck? I mean, they're both old. They said, well, they called the one Dial, but he weighed 25 pounds.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And when he didn't purr, he sounded like a bullfrog. So he's been renamed Kermie.
Okay.
Mm. Anyway, I put them both on a diet.
Mm-hmm.
And was watching what they were eating. Well, then he began to lose more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, this summer, three different times, and I'm a nurse, so a few of these things I'm a little
uh-huh.
bit aware of. Anyway, three different times, he did not go in his litter box.
Okay.
He urinated gross amounts of what looked like coffee.
Oh, my goodness.
And smelled foul.
Okay.
And so I thought, oh, boy, here we go. Well, I've thought he's older. I've had him in to the vet and had him checked.
Okay.
But the vet said he was doing okay. Anyway, he stopped eating.
Okay.
So I took him into the vet. The vet checked him over and said that he thought he was older than 8 years old as well, that he had a stone in the bile duct.
Okay.
And that at this point, he didn't think there was anything we could do.
Hmm.
He was not in any pain.
Okay.
And so I took him home, and I figured, okay, we'll just keep you comfortable, and as long as you're not in pain, that's fine.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I did, and I kept him a little separate because of this urine problem.
Mm-hmm.
But he got out of there.
Good.
And I thought, oh, this is different.
Yeah.
And so then I noticed over Labor Day weekend, there were a couple of marbles in his box.
Huh.
And now this cat at this point had not eaten. He hadn't eaten for a couple of weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
He's drinking water, but he's not eating.
Well, this is a real problem for overweight cats. When you've got a cat that is, and it sounds like he has some type of liver disease, and when we have a cat that stops eating for any reason or is put on too fast a weight reduction diet, they can run into troubles with what's called hepatic lipidosis or fatty liver disease. And I worry about that being the cause of your cat's problem over a plugged bile duct. I'm mm-hmm. not sure how your veterinarian diagnosed that. That would probably be something that either on x-ray or ultrasound would be a diagnosis that would be made that way. Maybe on some of the lab work would give you some indication that you've got a bile duct obstruction as well. But they are painful. Anybody that's had gallstones knows that
yeah.
is excruciatingly painful. And I can't believe that your veterinarian would say it's not painful because a gallstone would be. If he hasn't eaten in 2 weeks, he is one very, very sick cat. And whether this is secondary to being diabetic, secondary to liver disease, I think you need to find a veterinarian that would be willing to work with you to get some other lab work done, perhaps an ultrasound done on his abdomen to be able to assess his liver and his gallbladder. If he indeed has a gallstone, this would be something that can be surgically repaired. It is not an end-of-life type problem, and it is something that can be fixed. And mm-hmm. if he has fatty liver disease, he may need to be have a surgically placed stomach tube so that you can feed him. That is usually the cure, is feeding these cats and maybe force-feeding them, but actually through a stomach tube. You can't stress them out by giving it through their mouth. They just won't take in enough. Some cats do better on liver protective drugs. There's a couple of them on the market that we use, one called SAMe in particular, that you may be able to see over the counter for human use. There's a veterinary product available that we use. So I think that you've got a very ill cat, and all I can say is maybe it's time to, I don't usually say this, but find a different veterinarian that, you know, may be able to help you out a little bit better.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Gigi in Viroqua is back with us, I believe, so we'll go there. Hi, thank you
Hi.
For calling.
Thanks for taking me back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I have been using a prescription diet for a cat that had a bladder infection years ago, and he's very healthy. But we have four cats, and they all eat this very expensive and now in just increased in price.
Which diet is it?
It's you want the brand? Hill's Prescription Diet CD.
Okay.
And our one cat has been very healthy, and the other cats are healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if I can switch. You know, I hate to switch because it's like an insurance policy.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to just back up here just for a minute. Urinary tract infections in cats, true infections with bacteria, are rare in young cats. Cats under 10, the statistics are less than 2% of cats that come in with blood in their urine are due to having a urinary tract infection. It's usually due to either inflammation of the bladder wall or stones or something, and that's probably why your veterinarian puts your cat on this particular diet for long-term management. It means that he is probably predisposed to forming bladder stones and crystals, which could cause problems. So I'd be very reluctant to get your cat off this particular diet. But there's probably no reason why your other cats have to eat it, nor is that a reason that they all have to eat out of the same bowl. We get cats, and you know, with owners that have multiple dogs, no, you feed them separately. They go in their crates and so on. We can do the same thing with our cats. And meal feeding your cats where they get their particular diet that they need, and having them separated may be a little more work, but it's going to be, from the medical standpoint, probably better for everybody, because you're going to be able to regulate, one, the food that they're getting, and two, the amount that they're getting. So think about going to a little bit different feeding program rather than just putting it out all the time. That way your other two healthy cats don't have to be on the therapeutic diet that your other cat is on.
Okay, I'll give it a try.
Okay, right. Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, Terry and Marinette, I think, is next. Terry, hello.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Okay, I have a 10-year-old Great Dane, and he's really always been in really good health, except just recently, about a month and a half ago, his leg started dragging.
Mm.
And I taken him to the vet, and he's tried all different. He had him on antibiotics because he thought he might have gotten bitten by a tick.
Mm-hmm.
But it happened right after I had a kennel give him a bath.
Okay.
He was at a kennel where I always take him to board him, and I said, well, bathe him this time.
Yeah. The two common reasons why dogs will start dragging their feet, one is neurologic problems with the nerves going to the legs, and the other one would be muscle weakness. And so it's possible that he was injured if he slipped in the bathtub, or they had to lift him up to get him in. It's a big dog. So, you know, I think rather than looking into tick-borne diseases, which tend to cause fever and lameness, I'd be more concerned about, does your dog have some type of spinal cord problem? And that needs to be addressed and looked into, because they may be able to do something for that.
Okay, good luck. Thank you for calling. And Sandy had an email from Lindsay who says their dog has been itching a lot lately. She also feels some lumps on his back. Could it be stress or allergies? They live in River Valley, so it tends to be a lot of stuff in the air this time of year.
Yeah, and dogs that are itching because of allergies can get skin infections, and they may present as little scabby raised areas. And especially with short-haired dogs, they'd like to occur, rather than on the belly, up over the back. So this would be something going in, having some impression smears and samples taken to see if it is a bacterial infection, and getting them going on the appropriate antibiotic, which is usually for a minimum of 30 days, long-term.
Wow.
Yeah, it is. It's a long time to get a dog skin infection under control.
In our last minute, any final tips or advice?
You know, this is flea and tick season still. Ticks are coming out again, and fleas are out there. I had two in yesterday, so don't forget, even for these dogs with allergies, I can push them over the brink by adding a few fleas on and making them even itchier. So keep them on whatever your veterinarian recommends.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You'll be back on October 7th.
I think so, yeah.
We'll do it all over again.
All right.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk is a clinical professor in the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm really sorry we didn't get to everybody. We had people online for a while, but that's the way it goes sometimes. But she's back October 7th, so you can talk with her again then. Just taking a look ahead to tomorrow, we will be hearing from DNR Secretary Matt Flynn. He's going to be talking with us about boy, there's a variety of natural resource issues in Wisconsin to be addressed, and so he'll be talking with us about those issues. And then at 11:45, Dr. Javier Nieto, and Kathy Masoff talk about their ongoing survey of the health of Wisconsin residents, a statewide survey, and I think they have some interesting findings. So that's tomorrow. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.